It's really wonderful to be here, and I thank all of you for braving the rain to come out for the Israeli body. It's not really, we're not accustomed to this weather, and you know, my children were asking, what's it like? And I said, it's raining, and they couldn't even imagine that I'm in a place where it's raining right now. People often ask me about my story and getting to the Knesset, and how it happened, and what it was all about. I can tell you I never had any aspirations to get involved in politics. I was in chinuch, I was in education, I love teaching, I miss teaching, and it wasn't at all part of our plan. So what happened to get me there, and more importantly, some insights into the Knesset itself. So to paint the background to all of this, I have to share two anecdotes. The first, when my wife and I made the decision that we were going to make Aliyah, during the whole decision-making process, I had one fear the entire time. And that fear was, if we do decide to make Aliyah, how am I going to break this news to my grandmother? That was my fear. My grandmother, may she live and be well, is a Holocaust survivor. Here she is, she's in the golden years of her life, enjoying her grandchildren and her great-grandchildren. We lived in Maryland, she was in New York, we drove to see her all the time. And now I have to break this news to her. So I actually vividly remember, once we made the decision, picking up the phone and putting it down, picking it up, can I do this, putting it down. I couldn't do it. How do I tell her this news? And then I finally found the courage to break it to her. And I said, Bubby, I have some news for you. Bezrat Hashem, God willing, this summer, Dina, myself, the children, we're making Aliyah, we're moving to Israel. And I was prepared for what I call the wrath of Bubby. My grandmother says it the way it is. There's no political correctness. And rightfully so, she'd be upset that we're moving away from her. And I shared the news, and there was a pause on the other side of the phone. And then my grandmother said, Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu melech haolam shehechiyanu v'kimanu v'giyanu lazman hazeh. Took my breath away. And I said, Bubby, where did that come from? I wasn't expecting that reaction. She said, I want to tell you something. It's going to be very, very hard to have you so far away. She doesn't have Skype, FaceTime. She's not going to see us. It's going to be very, very hard. But she said, when she was on the boat from DP camp in Germany after the Holocaust to the United States, she said the entire way she was asking herself, why am I on a boat going in this direction to another foreign country to the Jewish people when I could be on a boat going in the other direction where a new Jewish state is being founded in the Jewish homeland? And she said, and even though our experience in America has far surpassed anything she could ever imagine, we've flourished here as a family, as a community, she has nothing but thanks to God to know that her grandchildren and great-grandchildren are settling in the land of Israel. That bracha from my grandmother rings in my ears every single day. Aliyah is not simple. There are a lot of challenges along the way. Certainly, as you'll hear in a few moments, the Knesset is very challenging, and politics in Israel, not simple. But just that perspective of my grandmother, sort of painting the picture of what's really happening over here, is something which I think about every single day. That's story number one. Story number two, just a few months later, July 2004, we drove up the New Jersey Turnpike, we went to JFK Airport, and we were there for this flight. If you haven't experienced a nefesh b'nefesh flight to Israel, there's no words to describe it. I can't describe it in words, what it feels like to board a plane with a few hundred people together, all making Aliyah. The enthusiasm and the excitement mixed together with anxieties and fears of a whole new life in a new world. Difficult to explain. But we get into the airplane, and we're getting our children settled. The oldest immigrant that summer was an 85-year-old gentleman making Aliyah. The youngest was our daughter, Zahava, who was 7 weeks old. By the way, she's Zahava, talking about Yom Yerushalayim. She was born on Chav Chet Iyar, so we named her Zahava. We're getting our children settled on the plane. And the pilot begins to speak to us, Israeli accent, presumably a former Israeli Air Force pilot. And he goes through the regular routine about the flight. And then he says, everybody sit back, relax, and enjoy the flight. I'm here to take you home. And he said those words, and I just froze in place. because the magnitude of what was happening just hit me. After 2,000 years of our family going from country to country and continent to continent, and every single one of them, we were either thrown out or we ran away, except for our experience here in the United States. Here we were on this beautiful jumbo jet by choice, standing proudly, not running away from something, but very much running to something. And we settled in Israel, we settled in Beit Shemesh. People often laugh when I tell them why we chose Beit Shemesh. I went on a pilot trip. My wife was very trusting, and I went alone on a pilot trip and drove around. My cousin was driving me around Beit Shemesh, and I saw so many different populations in Beit Shemesh. You have a Haredi population, a Chiloni population, Russians, Ethiopians, English speakers, native Israeli religious Zionists, everyone. I called my wife and I said, we have to live in Beit Shemesh to show our children how all these different populations of Jews live together in harmony and the Achdut. The Achdut of Am Yisrael, and so we learned pretty quickly that I was somewhat naive. We moved to an incredible country, which was 56 years old when we moved there. I mean, anybody who sees this story and doesn't see the open miracle, I don't know what they're looking at. A country surrounded on all sides by enemies determined to destroy it, and the country just fights them off with God's help, and we're just flourishing as a country. Everything was handed to us on a silver platter. Education for our children, health services, transportation, just remarkable. But we learned in Beit Shemesh pretty quickly, and this really brings us towards tonight's topic, that there's one thing we haven't figured out how to get right. And in my opinion, this that I'm touching on right now, this is the task that religious Zionism has to rise up to in our times. How do you take Jews from 2,000 years of different experiences all around the world, different cultural experiences, religious experiences, national experiences, and put them in this small little area we call Israel, and find a way to get along with another? That's what we haven't figured out. And that's what I saw play out in the streets of Beit Shemesh. It continues, sadly, here and then, to raise its head in Beit Shemesh as well. That's the challenge of our times. You know, in terms of our security threats, of course we have to focus on them. I'm not in any way belittling them and not taking them lightly. I mean, just look at this picture, right? We have the Iranian nuclear aspirations, ISIS creeping up on our eastern border, Hezbollah has 100,000 rockets that can reach anywhere in Israel, that can reach Eilat, anywhere in Israel, 10,000 rockets from Hamas and the terror tunnels, Palestinian terrorists. We have our security issues to deal with. But we focus so much on them, and we don't focus enough on what's happening to us internally. All of us know that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam, of our inability to get along with one another. We know from all of our sources, we will not have peace. We will not have Ge'ulah if we're not able to get along with one another from within. So that, from my perspective, for religious Zionists, that has to be our number one task. We have to find a way to take the lead in healing these wounds. And that's ultimately what brought me into political life in Israel, in this moment of total insanity. I decided to leave a world that I really loved in teaching, and to try to bring a religious voice to the political scene, where it's not religious against secular, it's not secular against religious, but that it's sort of trying to work together. And that, bless you, and that's ultimately what brought me to work with Yesh Atid, to get involved with Yair Lapid. And I had no aspirations to be in the Knesset at all. I didn't want to be a Chaver Knesset. That wasn't my life's dream in any way. I just wanted to be involved. And I figured I could continue my career in Chinuch and just be involved with this party sort of from the outside. As can only happen in Israel, government collapsed and it was time to make a list for Knesset. There are 120 seats in the Knesset based on the Anshei Knesset Hagdola. And every single party in Israel makes a list of 120 names for Knesset. They're very optimistic political parties. And Yair Lapid asked me to be number 17 on the Yesh Atid list. I accepted it with great honor. I said to him, even, I said, I know that I won't be a Chaver Knesset. That's fine. I just want to be involved. And then began the most incredible 2 months of an election campaign in Israel, traveling around Israel, crisscrossing north, south, east, west, just meeting Israelis. I left my little English-speaking bubble in Beit Shemesh and met Israel. And it was the most incredible 2 months, inspiring to just meet the people of Israel, people of such resilience and ingenuity. And we worked really hard, and there we are on election night. And it's really an amazing thing. I never once during the campaign said to anyone, vote for Yesh Atid so that I could be in the Knesset. It wasn't a possibility in my mind. And there we are on election night, we're in this big ballroom. And by the way, election day in Israel, that in and of itself is such a proof to the greatness of Israel. It's a proof to the greatness of Israel. We're in a neighborhood filled with dictators and no democracy whatsoever. And in all the chaos of Israel, 70 years now, functional elections, transition of power, it works. With all the chaos and the craziness that I might even share with you tonight, we had elections, people went and they voted, and there are election results that are announced, and there we are in this ballroom at night, and they announce at 10 o'clock at night, Yesh Atid wins 19 seats, and overnight I found myself elected to the Knesset, something which I wasn't expecting the entire time. The next day, the party arranged for us to have what we called Knesset school. All 19 of us in Yesh Atid were new to politics. That message, which clearly resonated in the last elections here, was part of our message. We're the outsiders. We're going to come in and show the politicians how to get things done. And so we had Knesset school. And we learned how things work in the Knesset, or don't work in the Knesset. The most incredible week and a half, where you realize, again, part of the miracle of Israel. How in the world, in 1948, 1949, 1950, while we have enemies who knows how many times more than our size fighting against us, how in the world do we establish a political? It's unbelievable. A political system that has rules. This is how it works. This is how you take an idea and make it into a law. This is how the committees work. A functional democracy with all of its systems in place that was built in wartime, while we were fighting for our lives. It's the most incredible thing. And as I was learning it, I remember thinking to myself, this is absolutely incredible what the founders of this state were able to do during the most impossible of circumstances. They put together a political system. They learned from different ideas that were out there. They took the parliamentary system. And it works. It functions. And we had to learn how to go about that. By the way, parenthetically, I came home one day from Knesset school, and there was an official letter waiting for me from the Knesset. And I remember exactly where I was standing because I was traumatized by this letter. The letter said that according to Israeli law, it's forbidden for me to be sworn in as a member of Knesset if I hold citizenship in another country. I was a mess. I come from a very patriotic American family. My father, Zichrono Livracha, was a judge in the U.S. government. My father-in-law was a U.S. Army chaplain for over 20 years. My wife grew up on U.S. military bases, including West Point. American flag flew outside our home all year round, and I have to go renounce my citizenship. For those of you who follow Israeli politics, you'll get a kick out of this. There were two of us who had to renounce our American citizenship. It was myself and Naftali Bennett. Naftali was so happy. He was like, he was giddy. He was like, get rid of this foreign citizenship thing. And I was an absolute mess. And they make you stand there and raise your right hand and you have to repeat after. I actually couldn't get through the words. I'm being honest, I couldn't. I hereby renounce my, I felt like an ingrate to a country which I do feel gave me and has given us so much. But I will tell you, then a few hours later, they give you your passport back with a big hole in it, and they give you a certificate which says you are hereby not an American, just to make it official. And a few hours later, though, I was thinking about it, and there was something really special to realize that 2,000 years ago, my ancestors were citizens of a commonwealth of some form in this land, and here I am. I'm Israeli. I have no formal ties or allegiances to any other country. Purely 100% towards the Jewish state and towards Israel. So 2 weeks later, you get to the inauguration, a lot of pomp and circumstance, an amazing day. Again, another moment where I just stood back, I'm sitting there in this chambers where so much of our history has played out, and just looking around the room and realizing the magnitude of what's happening over here, that I'm sort of miraculously taking my place in this place where, I mean, the topic here is where giants, I don't hold myself anywhere close to these people in terms of their leadership in Israel, and sitting there watching how a Jewish state transfers power in a free way, in a democratic way. Everybody stands there, takes the oath of office, and Hatikva, and they say Tehillim, beautiful, the most beautiful. I mean, the tears were in my eyes the entire time during the ceremony. And then it's time to get to work, and you actually feel what it's like to be in the Knesset. To be honest with you, my first order of business and my biggest fear and challenge in getting to the Knesset was the issue of Hebrew. I'm a proud graduate of 12 years of a Jewish day school education in America. I have nothing but thanks to my teachers and my schools, and I mean that very seriously. I'm not standing here in any way to put anyone down. They built me into who I am, and have nothing but gratitude. Hebrew language is not necessarily our badge of pride, and the truth is, it's pause for all of us to think about that for a moment. I mean, they had me in the building for 12 years. I was there for 12 years. I was a good kid. I did my work. I really think we should think about trying to step that up and make it even more of a priority that all Jewish children in Jewish day schools should be completely fluent in Hebrew. There's no reason why it shouldn't be that way. I wasn't fluent in Hebrew. And my biggest fear was that I was going to stand at the Knesset podium, that podium where so many great people stood and our giants and leaders have stood, and I'm going to make a complete mockery of myself. That was my fear. You know, in the meetings leading up to my time in the Knesset, I would speak Hebrew with people, and I always think to myself, did they have any idea if I was talking about past, present, or future? Because I was all over the place with that. And just in general, I had this fear that Eretz Nehederet, the Israeli version of Saturday Night Live, would have a dedicated character to the American in the Knesset who just can't really complete a sentence. And I was really afraid about this. So the Knesset gives every single member, a lot of people don't know this, every member of Knesset gets a budget to learn a second language. Most use it for English, some use it for Russian, some for Arabic, and I made Knesset history. I was the first sitting member of Knesset to use the budget to learn Hebrew. Every Sunday at 2:30, my tutor Nadav would come in, and this guy was a drill sergeant. And he would work me and give me homework and check my homework, watch my speeches from the previous week, critique them. And I speak to students all the time, especially to high school students and university students. I tell them, don't ever think that Hebrew language is the barrier stopping you from moving to Israel, serving in Israel, studying in Israel. I have no special skills when it comes to languages. I'm not a super genius. I was able to do it. I was able to sit and work really, really hard. My Hebrew was not at the level of my English, but I'm able to speak and not be afraid of making any kind of major mistakes. But I'll tell you, even after all of that, and I have no doubt that all of you have had this experience in Israel, you go to Israel and you have the courage to speak Hebrew. And how do Israelis respond to you? In English. And it makes us crazy, right? Is my Hebrew that bad? So I want to tell you something. Here I am, I'm a Chaver Knesset, I'm working on my Hebrew, and everyone from the security guard at the door, who I would say Boker Tov, and he'd say good morning, to the Prime Minister, I'm talking Hebrew, and people are talking to me in English. And it was something that was making me a little bit crazy. And I asked Mickey Levy, who was the former police chief of Yerushalayim and deputy finance minister, I asked him, why are you talking to me in English? Is it because is my Hebrew that bad? And he said, your Hebrew is fantastic. You're in the country 9 years and you're speaking this way. So I said, why the English from everyone? He said, we as Israelis, if we hear somebody with an English-speaking accent, especially America, we just want to feel like we're American. We want to be able to speak our English. So when you go to Israel, keep talking Hebrew, even if they're speaking to you in English. And over time, you know, Yair Lapid said to me one time, because he saw that I was uncomfortable about my American accent, and he said, sit and listen to one session in the Knesset for a moment, and just listen to the accents. And he's so right. You have people speaking Hebrew with Russian accents, with Ethiopian accents, with French accents, Moroccan accents, English speaking. It's a country of immigrants. And that's the beauty of it. It sort of plays this symphony of everyone contributing their little tune. And now we're bringing the English-speaking tune to Israel as well. And once he sort of framed it that way, it was so much easier for me to just get up and be able to speak. The environment in the Knesset is not really one which is conducive to an American who raises his hand and says, please excuse me and thank you. Doesn't really work so well. And I had to learn to develop the ability to express whatever issues I have with tremendous passion. It's not easy. There was sort of a breakthrough moment where a colleague of mine was, we were in a committee and there were some MKs that were sort of going after me in a personal way, and he started elbowing me in my side and he said, "Scream. You got to scream." I said, "I can't scream." He said, "You want to be a successful Chaver Knesset, you've got to pound on the table and scream." And I have to sort of build myself up to it and reach the point where I can actually do that. The Knesset is the most incredible place to be on a daily basis. The most incredible place to be. Because to me, more than anything else, it captures our aspirations for 2,000 years. For 2,000 years, we're begging God, please protect us from the Tsar. Please protect us from the Caesar. Please make sure that this person, that aspect, please make sure that the president is kind to us. That's our tefillah every Shabbat here. And here we are, and we have our own parliament, and we have self-determination, and we have the ability to determine our future. It's the most incredible blessing there could be to realize that. And I started noticing something about the Chavri Knesset. Before I was in the Knesset, I would read the Jerusalem Post or watch the news and see things that members of Knesset said. And I'd say, how can this person even be a Zionist? How can this person be Jewish? Like, what kind of a Jew speaks this way? I would make the political disagreements that I had with people personal. That's what I would do. And I think we all have a tendency to do that. You get to the Knesset and you realize, with all the screaming and the yelling that you see behind the scenes, there's incredible camaraderie, incredible unity, and friendships that cross party lines. You know, you all see, everybody sees the plenum where we meet in session. What you don't see is that right behind that room, there's another room, which unfortunately there are no cameras, and I wish there would be. And you can have two Chavri Knesset at each other's throats in the plenum when we're in session, and 10 minutes later, they're on those comfortable chairs behind the scenes talking to each other, how's the family, how's the vacation, best of friends. And it was an important lesson for me to learn. And the truth is, throughout Israel's history, if you study it, and I started reading more about it, there was an ability to separate between the political, and you can have the loudest possible political disagreement, and yet people were able to understand that when it's all said and done, all we have is each other. The greatest example of this, there was a minister who was in the government when I was in the Knesset named Uri Orbach, Zechor Levracha, for the Bayou D party. The sweetest soul you can imagine. Uri came over to me the day of the inauguration. He's in a different party. He's in Bayou D, I'm in Yesh Atid. He came over to me and he said, "Dov, you're new to the Knesset. Anything I do to help you, you know, please come and talk to me." And I did. I took advantage of it and he gave me advice about how to succeed in the Knesset. Uri passed away, unfortunately, at a young age. And when Uri Orbach was on his deathbed, who was with him around his bed in the hospital? His immediate family and his best friend. Who was his best friend? Member of Knesset, Ilan Gilon from the Meretz party. Think about this for a moment. Right wing religious party, Bayit Yehudi. Left wing secular party, Meretz. And they were the best of friends. And this was a really important lesson, which I learned in my time in the Knesset. And there's a story which sort of captures that. We were having a debate on this marathon session, which went from 4 o'clock in the afternoon till 3 o'clock the next morning, about the draft of the Haredim. And you can imagine the passions of that room and the screaming and the yelling, and everyone believes that what they're saying is right for the future of Israel, the Jewish people. And at about 9:30 at night, there was a pause in the screaming and the yelling for just a few seconds because the secretary of the Knesset had to check some technicality. There was a pause. And what did I hear during that pause? Mariv! And as can only happen in the Knesset, we all went to that back room and we davened Mariv together. Some of the quote-unquote secular members put napkins on their heads and joined us. I took a step back for a moment during Shema. I said, look at this. Right here we are, fighting against one another, debating one another about this critical issue, and on completely different sides of the equation, and yet here's something which brings us together. And this is a critical, critical point to understand in terms of the Knesset. From my perspective, when we talk about what should we be doing in the Knesset as religious Zionists, what should the agenda be, on a certain level, I feel that we've lost our way. And let me explain what I mean by that. If you go back historically, religious Zionism, when the State of Israel was founded, was about making sure that we bring as much Judaism and religion into this state as possible. That was essentially the breakoff that took place between Rav Kook and Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld. In 1913, Rav Kook, who was the leader of the religious Zionist community, Rav Zonnenfeld, who was the leader of the Haredi community in Yerushalayim, they went on a tour together all around Israel to try to reach out to the secular founders of the State of Israel, who were very, very secular, even anti-religious, people we revere. We revere for what they did in establishing the state, but the reality is they wanted a state with a new Judaism, without God, without mitzvot, without Torah. So they traveled around to all the kibbutzim and to all the settlements to try to see the story and see what they could do to influence it. And Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld saw what was happening. Pork, eating on Yom Kippur. And he said, that's it. We can't have anything to do with this venture and circle the wagons, and that's, you know, someone else's project. We're not involved in this. And Rav Kook said, wait a minute. There was one kibbutz where they agreed to have a kosher kitchen. There was another kibbutz where they agreed to have something on Yom Kippur. And he focused on that element of it, of where can we have influence, and that really became the basis for religious Zionism, and even on a political level, when the state was founded. 1948 to 1967, that is what religious Zionism was working on, trying to do as much to bring Judaism to this state as possible, and really salvaged a state which could have gone in a very different direction by doing so. That's one of the reasons why politically they always wanted to have Misrad HaChinuch, they always wanted to have the education department to have an influence, and as a result, year after year you had Chatan Tanachs on Yom HaTzma'ut who were secular, because they were learning Tanakh, they were learning about Judaism, and they were connected in this way. I wouldn't say that during those years secular Israel was ready necessarily for the message. They were still in the format of trying to build this new Judaism and divorce ourselves from spirituality and from religion, but yet we were hard at work in trying to do that. Then came this incredible miracle called the Six-Day War, which we're celebrating 50 years, and two shifts took place in two different communities. A shift in the religious Zionist community, politically I'm talking about right now, became the issue of Yehuda and Shomron. And the idea of, and I understand it, I'm not here in any way condemning anyone or criticizing anyone. It was, wow, something further has taken place to bring us towards Mashiach. Uniting Yerushalayim, getting back Yehuda and Shomron, who could have imagined that this would happen? And the focus, because religious Zionism always saw Israel as the beginning of the state, of the beginning of the coming of Mashiach, so that became a major focus politically to make sure that we hold on to these lands and to fight against any attempts to give up these lands, and that became a major focus, and we started to lose our focus on the chinuch side and on the education side and what Israel is internally. And by the way, we relinquished what Judaism is in the Jewish state to the Haredim along the way. Just relinquished it. And they were able to determine what Judaism should be in the Jewish state. But here's the crazy part. What else happened during the Six-Day War? And this is not me saying it. If Yair Lapid was standing here, he would tell you this. Secular Israel started waking up. A shift took place in secular Israel during the Six-Day War where they realized, wait a minute here. There's something at work here beyond just the might of the IDF. There's something else happening, and a process, a slow process of a spiritual awakening started to happen. That, the result of that, you're seeing right now. The term secular is a term that I learned in the Knesset. It's a misnomer. It really is. Secular Israelis make Kiddush on Friday night, they light Shabbat candles, they fast on Yom Kippur, they don't eat Chametz on Pesach, they light Hanukkah candles. Secular Israel. I'll never forget, I really felt this moment. I was working out in the gym, and Maccabi Tel Aviv was playing a soccer game against Chelsea in England. And it was a big, big match. I don't follow soccer at all. But they were covering it on Channel 1, and they had the feed from Europe, because Europe was watching this game. And right before the match started, they focused in first on the superstar for Chelsea, I don't know his name, and then they focused at the center court, center field, They focused on the superstar from Maccabi Tel Aviv. His name is Iran Zahavi. And the match is about to begin, and Iran Zahavi, who doesn't have the kippah on his head, goes like this on camera. He said Shema. It was this incredible moment to see this secular Israeli, right, who's the star of Maccabi Tel Aviv, proudly in front of all of Europe, saying Shema before the game started. And that's what I started learning. Secular Israel is actually going through a reawakening, and there's learning going on like you cannot imagine. I call it the Ruth Calderon Revolution. Ruth was a member of our party who got up to give her inaugural address with the Gemara and gave a speech like you cannot imagine in a scene that can only happen in the Knesset. The speaker at that moment was a deputy speaker from Shas, and they started talking about the Gemara together. This incredible scene, this incredible scene playing out. Shavuot night, all over Israel. All over Israel, I'm blessed to be part of this. We give shiurim to secular Israel. They stay up all night to learn in cinematheques all over Israel. It's the most incredible thing that's happening. And the challenge that we have to rise to is to recognize that this is happening. And I'm not saying that people who politically believe are on the right in Israel, of course they should fight for that. Everyone should fight for what they believe in. And believe me, I'm not a person who's very quick to say we should give up Yehuda and Shomron, and I'm certainly against dividing Yerushalayim. And we have to keep that focus. But we should remember the other elements. And I want to talk to you about some of the issues that are coming up in Israel where the religious Zionist community has to take the lead to heal the wounds in Israeli society. Because like I said, secular Israel is interested. They're interested. The religious Zionist community has to come in and meet with them and get involved in these issues. And I want to describe to you issues that came up in the Knesset. They're on the table right now in the Knesset. Issues that we dealt with, that I certainly dealt with when I was there, where I believe if we rise to the occasion to try to work on these issues, that ultimately is what can lead towards achdut, towards the idea of coexistence and tolerance for one another, and ultimately lead to the Geula. What are those issues? So a quote-unquote secular Israeli, who I just described to you a moment ago as being interested in spirituality, they're not interested in someone forcing religion on them. They have interest in Judaism, they want to learn more. I'm not talking about some kind of a mass kiruv movement. I'm talking about people who are interested and they want to be proud Jews in a Jewish state. But I travel around Israel and I meet young secular Israelis and they say to me the following, two sentences. The first one is, we hate Judaism. Think about this. After 2,000 years, we've returned to our homeland, we're building a Jewish state, and we hate Judaism. But there's a second part to that sentence. They say, and we hate that we hate Judaism. They're not looking for a way out, they're looking for a way in. And we have to find a way to release the stranglehold that they feel of religious coercion, where they feel that it's being forced on them politically, and create some kind of breathing space, and create a scenario where everyone can feel at home in Israel. So just to give you a few examples of the issues that are on the table. The first, and this is a big one, is the issue of marriage in the state of Israel. It's a big, big issue. What do we do? What do we do? On the one hand, it's a Jewish state, and in a Jewish state, marriage in Judaism has always been a spiritual ceremony between a man and a woman. That's what it's always been. So we have to preserve that in a Jewish state. On the other hand, it's a Jewish and a democratic state. And there are people who don't want to be forced into that path. They don't want that. And they want something else. And we have 10,000 couples a year that go to Cyprus for a civil marriage and then come back and live in Israel. And when you talk to young secular, this is the one issue which pushes them away from religion actually the most. That they feel that someone is coming in at this most important moment in their lives and forcing them to do something that they don't want to do. So what do? How do we find that balance? So I believe, and this is an issue, it's a law that's on the Knesset table, it's not going to pass in this government, but it's one which ultimately, B'ezrat Hashem, will come into play, is to create two tracks in Israel. One is a marriage track, where we say marriage is exactly what I said before. Marriage is a religious ceremony between a man and a woman, done through the Rabbanut, a Rabbanut that has to be far more embracing and accepting and explaining. That's one track. But if you don't want that track, to provide the opportunity for civil unions, not civil marriages, but civil unions, a contract between two people who are given the rights as a married couple, but not through what a process called marriage, and not through a ceremony called marriage. And we worked with Rabbanim on the contract, the language, to work out all kinds of halachic issues. That is the kind of compromise which we need to bring to broader Israel. On the one hand, say marriage has always been a certain way, it's going to stay that way in a Jewish state. But to give people the ability to breathe. And by the way, if we put on our religious hats for a moment, we actually have to do this, and I'll tell you why. When we force secular Israelis to get married, Kedat Moshe Yisrael, according to Halacha, and we create a status of Eshet Ish, what happens when, sadly, too often, the couple decides they don't want to stay together? They don't bother going to the Rabbanut for a divorce, because who wants to go through that mess? They just separate from one another. They meet new partners. They have children together with those partners. And now, because we're so religious that we're demanding that they get married according to Halacha, we, on the religious side, are creating Mamzerut in the state of Israel. That's what we're doing. And therefore, to give people who have no interest in anything religious another option is something that we have to do on a religious level. By the way, I mentioned this to some of the members of Shas. You're always in the Knesset working together with other parties, trying to convince them to join your initiatives. And I mentioned to one of the guys in Shas, and he said to me, you know what? I just realized, Rabbi Avadi Yosef, Zechor Tzadok Levracha, once told us, if we're Masada Kedushin, and we analyze exactly what I just told you right now, we analyze that there's a secular couple, they're not going to bother with a get, and we can lead to Eshet Ish. Rabbi Avadi Yosef told us, use invalid witnesses under the chuppah. Civil marriage sort of under the carpet without being open about it, right? So we should stand up and say, you have these two options. This is an example where it's not a religious party anymore. Religious Zionist party saying, we are here to fight for these religious principles. It's a religious Zionist movement which is saying, we understand that there's broader Israel. Now we have to figure out what's the best way to move forward with broader Israel, even if it's not exactly the ideal that we're striving for at this point. And by the way, if we actually do this, you can hear the collective sigh from broader Israel, and don't be surprised how many secular Israelis will choose the marriage track when it's not something which is being forced on them, because that's part of the reawakening which is happening. So that's an example of an issue, by the way, which is pulling the Knesset apart. I mean, the disagreements that we have about this issue are very, very strong, but it's one example of a major, major issue where I believe religious Zionism has to play a major role in figuring out a solution. Another issue which we're dealing with is the issue of conversion in the state of Israel. During the 1990s, the Iron Curtain came crumbling down, and close to 1 million Russians moved to Israel, changing the face of Israel. But amongst those close to 1 million people were a few hundred thousand who are not Jewish according to Halacha. They have a Jewish father, they have a Jewish grandfather, they're allowed to come to Israel under the right of return, but they're not Jewish. So what do we do about it? What do we do about it? We can't just sit back, by the way, and say we'll do nothing. Because for the first time, we're going to start having intermarriage issues in Israel. Because they're living in Israel, they have Hebrew names, they speak Hebrew, they serve in the army, they go to university, and our children will meet their children, and we're going to have intermarriage in the state of Israel. But what do we do about that? I always grew up learning that in order to convert, you have to stand up in front of a Beit Din and accept to keep all the mitzvot. These are not people who are in that position to do that, so what do we do about it? And then I read a sefer by a very brave former member of Knesset, Rabbi Chaim Amsalem. He was thrown out of his party, the Shas party, for these opinions. A few hundred pages where he writes all the sources you can imagine to show that there are three categories. One category is people that are born Jewish. One is people that are completely coming from the Gentile world. And there's a third category called Zera Yisrael, people who come from Jewish descent. They have a Jewish father, grandfather. They come from the Jewish people. They're not halachically Jewish. And Rav Amsalem shows that the criteria for them to convert to Judaism is not the same demand that we would make for a Gentile coming from nowhere. And he shows the sources, Rishonim, Achronim, who talk about this concept. We, again, as leaders who want to see a Jewish state thrive, we have to be reaching out to the Russian community and offering them the opportunity to convert to Judaism. According to halakha, yes, lenient opinions within halakha, but that's what leadership's all about. It's easy to be strict. The question is, when you have an eight lasot, you have a problem on your hands, and you want to save a Jewish state, you have to be brave enough to say, we'll rely on lenient opinions. By the way, even if we don't want to rely on those opinions for that, one approach which is ironclad in halakha, and by the way, it doesn't sound Jewish at all, but it's clear, there's no dissenting opinion, you could go and take children who are under bar mitzvah, and literally go to their parents and say, do you want them to be Jewish? And their answer will be yes. You put them in mikvah with no Kabbalah mitzvot at all, and they're Jewish, according to halakha. There's no other opinion. This is the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch. It sounds strange to us. We have to be doing that. We have to be thinking about the future of Israel. What's going to happen with all these Russians who have come here? And by the way, I always think to myself, if my great-grandfather didn't come to America when he did, I would be them. I would be them. We were in Russia. He left and came to America. But if he didn't, I would be these people right now. They come from us. They were part of the Jewish faith, and we owe it to them to reach out and to bring them in. Another example where, yes, through the Knesset, because the Knesset doesn't get involved in halakha, but the Knesset has to give the authority to rabbis who are willing to do these conversions, to do these conversions. Right now, politically, it's been determined that conversions can only be done through one body, and that body is being stringent and not allowing us to open those doors. Another example where I believe, again, religious Zionism could stand up and say, we are going to take the lead on an issue. We are going to save Israel from a potential catastrophe of intermarriage by allowing ourselves to use halakha in a creative way to bring these people in and enable them to convert to Judaism. Marriage, conversion. There are other issues. Aguna is a major issue in the state where, again, we have to be courageous and bold and show leadership. Just to show you one little anecdote that can only happen in the Knesset. You want to talk about behind the scenes in the Knesset. So I went to Rabbi Lau, the current chief rabbi, and I said to him, is there anything I can do as a Chaver Knesset to help with the Aguna issue? So he said, I'm so happy. Someone wants to partner and do something. Yes. He said to me, there are 15 men who are in jail. They're imprisoned in Israel because the situation is so bad and they haven't given their wives a get. He said, but they're in what's called the Agaf HaTorani of the Israel prison system. They're sitting and they wake up in the morning and they have shacharit, they have breakfast, and they sit all day in an air-conditioned Beit Midrash, learning Torah all day. They're kings, they're in Kollel. No pressure whatsoever to give their wives a get. So I said to Rabbi Lau, can I write a law? Would you support a law that says that a person who is in jail because he hasn't given his wife a get cannot claim to be religious and be in the religious part of jail? He said, absolutely, you have my support. I said, great. I'm walking out of the room, and he says to me, Dov, add one more clause to the law. Add to the law that they cannot ask to have the Mahadran kosher food while they're in this situation. He said, there are two guys who the next day, they're giving their wife a get if they can't have Mahadran food. So I said, okay. I go to the Knesset, I sit down with my staff, we write the law. The first step of any law is it goes to the Knesset attorney's office. The Knesset attorney is the one who, if the law goes to court, he has to represent the Knesset and defend the Knesset in court. So it goes to him, I get a phone call from the Knesset attorney, he says, you have to come meet with me. I was in shock. I go to his office, and this was a 4-hour meeting, which I'll condense to 2 minutes. He said, I cannot support this law. He said, I don't understand. He said, a murderer can claim to be religious and be in the Torah division of jail, but a guy who hasn't given his wife a get can't? I can't defend this. So I felt like I was back in the Beit Midrash and we were going at it, and I said, of course I can explain it. A guy, someone who, God forbid, murders someone, they have to be in jail the rest of their life. But in theory, we believe 5 minutes later, a year later, 10 years later, they can do tshuva. They can regret and have full remorse for what they've done. And they can be a fully religious person, even though they've committed this terrible avera, this terrible, they've broken the law in this way. I said, but the guy who hasn't given his wife a get, every single moment he's sitting there, he's continuing to commit the crime or the sin, however you want to define it. So he accepted it, and now goes to the next step of the law. What's the next step of the law? It goes to the Ministerial Committee of Legislation. So this is a committee of ministers, and you have to get a simple majority of the ministers to allow the law to go to the Knesset floor. So whenever you want to pass a law, you have to go around to the ministers to make sure you have their support. I didn't even bother going to the secular ministers because I assumed for sure they're going to support this law. I went just to the religious ministers, made sure I had their support, and it goes to the committee. Would you believe the secular ministers, including ministers from my own party, they rejected the clause about the Mahadran food? Because they said human rights, people have the right to eat whatever they choose. So just take a step back for a moment, and this is the scene. Secular ministers in the Israeli government are fighting for the right for religious get refusers to have Mahadran food in jail. This was the scene which played out. So I had to accept to remove that clause. The law then went to the Knesset floor. There is nothing more thrilling than standing in front of the Knesset and explaining your law and calling on the members to vote for the law. It passes in the vote. Don't get too excited. And then it has to go to committee. It has to come out of committee back to the Knesset floor. It has to then go back to committee again and then be voted out of committee, and then it goes for its last two votes on the Knesset floor. So it's a long process. It takes an average of about 2 years for a law to go through all the steps. And lo and behold, before it finished, the government fell apart and the law wasn't able to continue. But I'm very thankful that member of Knesset Shuli Mualim from the Baidudi party has taken the law on this Knesset and starting to move through its various stages. But just gives you again a sense of some of the issues that we can deal with. And I do believe it's the role of religious Zionists in the Knesset, like I said before, not just to fight for Yehuda and Shomron, that's a very good fight to fight, and not just to fight for Yerushalayim, we have to fight for that, but to also focus on these internal issues. And then we get to Chinuch. This past Yom HaAtzma'ut, we had the first Chiloni Chatan Tanakh in 30 years in Israel. It's a badge of great pride, and we're thrilled that it happened, but we have to get back to that approach. I'm very, very happy that the last two ministers of education, one was Rabbi Shai Peron from our party, a religious Zionist rabbi, and now it's Naftali Bennett from the Baidudi party. People who are coming with a religious orientation, who are trying to figure out how can we find a way to get secular Israel to have a basic Jewish education as part of their years in school. And this is going to take Israel to the next step because they're ready for it. Why do I say they're ready for it? Because of one other transformation that has taken place, and that's in the army, where you have officers wearing kippot in numbers that we've never seen before. It never used to be that way in the army. The religious Zionist community in Israel has stood up, and it's thanks to a lot of different projects, certainly Hezder, certainly Mechinot like Eli, and we have officers throughout the army that are religious, and their soldiers see them, and there's a relationship that's developed between them. It's the most incredible thing to see. I have a son right now, we're very proud, who's a Golani soldier, and he talks about what goes on, he's a Ben Yeshiva, who came from Keren Biavne, and the interaction with the Chilonim. There's amazing things that are happening, a tremendous opportunity, which hopefully we can rise up, and hopefully we can make a difference. One other area that I got involved with in the Knesset where religious Zionists have to be more involved, and that's the issue of public diplomacy, making the case for Israel. Then my second week in the Knesset, I got a call that there were 20 members of the French parliament in the Knesset, and they asked me to go meet with them. And I said, I have no background in foreign affairs at all. I'm not your guy. And without saying this, they basically said, you're one of the few guys who speaks English, get into the room with them. So I go into the room and I start speaking about all the wonderful things happening in Israel, technology and medical advances, and there's just been a natural disaster somewhere, and Israel was the only country with a field hospital there. All the things that we're so proud of about our state. I'm no more than 5 minutes into this presentation, and a member of the French parliament interrupts me. It was very startling. He says, excuse me, sir, we're not here to talk about all these things that you're describing to us. We're here to tell Israel to stop building settlements. He says, because Israel is building settlements, that's why the Middle East is in flames, and because of Israel, radical Islam is spreading all around the world and has even reached France. Whoa. I don't mind having a conversation with anybody about settlements. I don't mind having that conversation. We can have a conversation. I don't always agree with the Israeli government's policies. I'm right now in a party that's in opposition. We can have a conversation about different things. But to suggest that because Israel's building settlements, that's why the Middle East is in flames, or because of Israel, radical Islam is spreading around the world, that's not something I'm willing to accept. And I used the platform that I had as a Chaver Knesset to travel around the world to parliaments and to college campuses and to make the case for Israel. But I'm making the case for Israel, we as religious Zionists have a very important role to play, where it's not just focusing on the last 70 years, and it's not just focusing on, well, there was a Holocaust, and therefore we need Israel, but to come from it from the perspective which Ben-Gurion himself presented to the Peel Commission in 1936, where he held up the Tanakh and he said, this is our mandate for this land. We have to get back to talking like that. It's not just about, yes, Israel's great, Israel has human rights, Israel has justice, but to talk about it from a religious Zionist perspective, to share that with the world, to make the case for Israel from our perspective. We are losing out there. We're losing out there. And one of the reasons that we're losing out there, from my perspective, is because we don't have that heart and soul. If it's just some kind of an intellectual conversation, we lose. But if we come to it with a perspective of, this is our homeland, this is the place where Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov walked. This is the place where David HaMelech and his son Shlomo ultimately built the Beit HaMikdash. If we talk in those terms, and that's why, by the way, this Yom Yerushalayim is so important. If we talk in those terms and bring it back historically, that's where we have a much greater claim to the land. And people respect us even more if we come from that perspective. So another area where we have to make our impact. I want to give time for questions. I just want to close with two last points. When we talk about religious Zionism, we have to also recognize and talk and talk and talk and feel the incredible times in which we live. The incredible times in which we live, and share that with our next generations, both in Israel, but also throughout the diaspora. The average Israeli child growing up today in Israel has to be filled with a recognition of the magnitude of what's happening. If I go back for a moment to my grandmother's bracha, of her Shachianu. And children of the diaspora have to understand that as well. They have to understand, you know, for 2,000 years, our ancestors opened up the Tanakh and they saw, God said we'll be exiled from our land. While we are not in our land, it will remain shmama. It will be desolate. Nothing will grow there. Sure enough, that's what happened throughout our history. Throughout the history, the greatest conquerors tried to take over this land. They couldn't get anything to grow there. But the Navi says, we read it in the Haftorah this past Shabbat, the Navi Amos says, and there's other Nevi'im as well, the time will come, it says, there will be a day when the land will flourish again, and the vines will be dripping with wine, and the trees will give forth fruit. We're living in that time today. Our ancestors believed it would happen. It's happening right in front of our eyes. We don't have to believe it anymore. It's happening. But we have to talk about that. We have to talk about that and recognize the magnitude of the times that we're living in. Kibbutz Galiot. For 2,000 years, our ancestors believed the time will come. The time will come when there will be some kind of an ingathering of the exiles. Every Monday at 2:30, our party meets in the Knesset, and I look around the table, and I see immigrants from Ethiopia, from the former Soviet Union, from Morocco, from Tunisia, from European countries, from English-speaking countries. The land of Israel is opening up its arms. And it's saying, come back home to Jews all around the world. Children in Israel have to recognize the incredible times that they're living, and that's the role that religious Zionism can play to teach that. We have to be speaking about it from the Knesset podium all the time. We have to talk about it wherever we are. And then if I could transfer that to the diaspora for a moment, we have to talk about it to our children here as well. And we have to be courageous and be willing to talk about one topic which I never heard about growing up. I grew up waving the flag, Yom HaAtzmaut, parades and everything else. No one ever talked to me about Aliyah. No one ever talked to me about this idea of, it's our home. It's our home that God has given to us, and that every single child should at the very least consider and explore their options to make it their home. It's not a comfortable topic to talk about, but that has to be part of the fabric as well of religious Zionism, to recognize the magnitude of the times that we live and actually teach about it. Had no teacher in a Jewish day school ever stand up in front of a class and say to me, the Ramban holds that there's a Torah obligation to live in the land of Israel. No one ever said those words to me. Let me have the information and make a decision. No one ever told me the story of the Chafetz Chaim. I heard about the Chafetz Chaim in Lashon Hara all the time. How the Chafetz Chaim writes how all his life, all he wanted to do was live in the land of Israel. And he and his wife finally decided they're doing it. They were older. They made all the plans. And the day they were supposed to get on the ship, his wife fell ill. They had to go to a doctor, and that was it. And they couldn't go. And how he bemoans the fact that he didn't make it to live in the land of Israel. We have to talk about it. And by the way, it's never too late. to take up that element of religious Zionism. Last week, I spoke at a birthday party in Beit Shemesh for a 100-year-old woman, Holocaust survivor, who made Aliyah 7 years ago at the young age of 93. She made Aliyah at 93. Retirement in Israel, there's nothing like it. My mother's story is a little bit different than most. She made Aliyah as a good Jewish mother in order to vote for me in the elections. But after she did so, retirement's incredible. She's running around day and night, shiurim and tours and things that are happening. The most incredible retirement you can imagine. But certainly to our young children, to inspire them and talk about it. And when children call after going to their gap year and they tell their parents and grandparents that I want to stay and I want to join the IDF as a lone soldier, we should celebrate it. We should dance to know that we've raised children with that value. That's the ultimate dream, to know that you have a child who's willing to do such a thing. What greater pride can there be for the Jewish people for a child to show that value, that set of values? That's what religious Zionism has to be about. Yes, it's support for Israel. Yes, it's visits to Israel. But it's also about talking about this is our home. And no matter how comfortable we are in America, and we have to be thankful for it, as Rav Shlomo Feivel Mendelovich said it, and it's only he could say it, he said that Jewish America, in his perspective, it's like the polar bear in the Bronx Zoo. He said, look at the polar bear in the Bronx Zoo, and it looks like he has everything. He has his ice and the snow and the food that he needs and his habitat. But if you zoom out, he's in the middle of the Bronx. That's the same thing. We're not in our natural habitat. And to talk about it that way and to encourage it, that also has to be a part of religious Zionism. Bezrat Hashem, if all of us rise to the occasion and recognize the incredible times in which we live, the opportunity that God has given us, for religious Zionism to lead the way in bridging the gaps in Israel on all of these core issues, in the Knesset, outside the Knesset, if we talk about the incredible gift that God has given to us, and we do speak openly about making Israel our home, and we do encourage our kids to be there and to hopefully stay there, Bezrat Hashem, that's the next step that we need to take us from the Yemot HaMashiach, the Messianic times, and bring us to the time, Bezrat Hashem, of the Geulah Shleima. I thank all of you for listening. I'll be happy to answer questions. Remember that I went through two election campaigns in Israel. No question is too personal or off limits. So, yes. I have a great story to answer that. So the question was, now that I'm not in the Knesset, can I get my citizenship back? So you have to hear this story. So after I renounced my citizenship, I went up Dan Shapiro, who was the ambassador, an excellent, excellent ambassador to the United States to Israel. He called me up to his office and I met with him. We became very close. He said to me, by the way, he says, if you're ever not in office, just ask for your citizenship back, you'll get it back. I said, really? I didn't even know that. He said, yeah. So the night of the elections in 2015, when I lost my seat in Knesset, so Dan sent me a text message. He said, sorry that you didn't get elected. Let's have a coffee sometime. Let's talk. I said, sure. By the way, you mentioned to me about my citizenship back. How do I do that? He said, the attorney of the embassy will write you a letter tomorrow explaining it to you. I said, great. The next day I get an email. Dear Mr. Lippman, you renounce your citizenship without coercion, willfully. You cannot get your citizenship back. It was a pretty harsh letter. You could go to court in America. I said, I'm not going to do that. So then I said to the ambassador, I want to travel to America. How do I go? Because you have to get a visa. I mean, I'm thinking to myself, I'm 32 years, I lived in America. I have to get a visa to come to America. So he told me which visa to ask for. So I went to the embassy. I waited online for 2.5 hours in line. I got to the clerk to have an interview. And she says to me, why are you traveling to America? I said, to speak. And she said, oh, you asked for the wrong visa. I'm sorry, I can't tell. I said, really? The ambassador told me to ask for this visa. She said, the ambassador? Why were you talking to the ambassador? I said, oh, I used to be a Chaver Knesset, so I became friends with him. She said, wait a minute. You used to be a member of Knesset and you waited for 2.5 hours in line? I said, I'm a regular citizen. I'm not asking for any favors. She says, an honest politician? Here's your visa. So I have my Israeli passport, I have a visa, I wait in the long line to get into my country that I grew up in. They fingerprint me and take my picture every time I come in. But I have to tell you, it's a great pride to wait with the Israelis in line. I love it. So it's really not a problem. Yes, sir?
Do you plan to run again for Knesset?
So I'm still, the question was, do I plan to run again? I'm very actively involved in the party still to this day. And I will be running in the next elections. Yair, when he introduces me or talks, my official title right now is a chakal, which is a chaver knesset l'sha'avar. That's the official title in Israel. Everything in Israel is abbreviations and acronyms. But Yair calls me a chaver knesset l'sha'atid. Future member of Knesset. So Bezat Hashem, that's the plan. And according to the polls, it looks very good for the party in terms of what will be. So hopefully I'll be back in. Yes?
What made you decide to join Yesh Atid?
The question was, why did I join Yesh Atid? My first thought was, it's very comfortable to go to a religious party. It's very comfortable. And I just don't believe that's what Israel needs right now. I think Israel needs people who are willing to work together. That was the first step. Now, I have to believe in the ideology, though. So I met with Yair Lapid, and I always say, if everybody could have 5 minutes with him, people would have a very different perspective about him. Incredible, incredible person. Very often people associate him with his father. He talked about the screaming matches he had with his father when he expressed that he believes in God and his father did not. A very passionate Jew, not a practicing Jew. Very passionate, and we talked through all the issues, and issue after issue, I agreed with what he said about what Israel needs to do. So that's when I felt comfortable joining with the Yesh Atid. It's been an incredible experience to be part of this party. The first Purim in the Knesset, my wife and I were saying, who should we have over for the Purim suit? I said, do you think anybody in the party would come if we invited them? So she said, give it a shot. So I wrote to the email list of the party. I said, we're having our Purim suit, everybody's invited. So Yair actually answered within seconds, and he said, "Anachnu magiim halapidim." That's what he said. Where Lapid family's coming, and we had the entire party over at our house in Beit Shemesh. I always say, my block was never so protected before because we had all these ministers and Shabbat was all over the place. We had the most incredible suda. Ruth Kelleron gave this Dvar Torah about contrasting the feminism of Vashti and the feminism of Esther. And explaining why the feminism of Esther is the best way for women to try to move forward with tzniut and not in your face and sophistication and nuance. And it was incredible. Just surreal experiences. We had this get-together at Yair Lapid's house. Especially in the beginning, they wanted the party to know each other, to become a family, to coalesce together. We had these events of gibush. And we were talking. We had and then at the end of the night, Yair said, okay, everybody get in a circle. And then this famous Israeli singer was there and got into the middle of the circle with his guitar. I said to myself, oh no, what's going to happen now? And the guy starts singing Adon Olam, and we all sing Adon Olam together. This incredible experience. Another thing that happened, which was really, really captures this, the parties are everybody's comfortable with each other and very touchy-feely and a lot of it. And for myself and Shai Peron, as religious people, so we had a conversation with the women in the Yesh Atid just about some of the halachic issues that we have. We explained it fine. It was a very nice meeting and very cordial. I didn't know what people really think about it. I gave my inaugural address. You can watch the video of this happening. While I was in the middle of my inaugural address, while I was speaking, it hit me. I said, oh my gosh. When I finish, everybody always comes over and says, congratulations. And on national TV, I'm going to start getting hugged and everything by the women in Yesh Atid and whatever. That's what's it's going to happen. It happens in life. It's not the end of the world. But I know that there's going to be a lot of criticism and there's going to be articles about it. And I get off the podium. So the way the Knesset was set up at that time, Yair Lapid was the first person sitting there. So he gave me a big hug. And then I looked. The women of Yesh Atid thought about this in advance, and they each handed me a flower. They planned it out in advance, meaning they were so sensitive to where I'm coming from religiously, and that's some of what I've experienced being part of this party, and given platforms to speak to Chiloni Israel that I would never have otherwise. And it's not always comfortable. There are sometimes issues that come up which I have to work through, but I really believe that it's my political home, and I'm very proud of what the party has accomplished, and Bezat Hashem, what it will accomplish. Yes?
We all know what a Baal Tshuva is and the Baal Tshuva movement. I understand that Israel now, from people coming out of the better schools in Jerusalem, like Hartman and the better schools, they go into the army, and they're now part of a, I don't know if it's a movement called the Baal Shela movement, where they're questioning things, and the people who come from these great Jewish backgrounds, and then they're questioning it. How could these people, who have the background, but are now in with the regular secular people, and they're questioning their own backgrounds, where could we use them? And I understand the numbers are growing tremendously.
So, I don't know about the numbers growing tremendously, but I will tell you that if a religious child who grew up in a religious home goes to the regular army at the age of 18, not because there's some agenda in the army to make people secular as it might be painted, not because of that. They're putting themselves in a very secular environment, and they haven't had the years post-high school to build yourself in learning or whatever else it is. They lose their religiosity. It happens. I see it happening in people that I know. But, and that's why I tell everyone, you should send your child to the army, of course, but in a certain framework. And again, I'll just use the example of my son, just because it's so personal. After high school, he went to yeshiva for almost 2 years, built himself up and got really into learning there, and then he joined the army with his shir. And the yeshiva had all kinds of preparation beforehand. And he joined the army together with his shir. And now he's at the point where it's starting to integrate with the rest of the army as well. But you build them up in that way and you prepare them. And then the exact opposite can happen. They can have a positive influence on the army. But it has to be within a certain framework. And that's, again, if you talk about accomplishments of the religious Zionist movement, the Hezder Yeshiva, that's where you can have, but to send an 18-year-old kid at that impressionable age, just throw him to people who are secular in background, if you don't have the framework, not because anybody's trying to make them less religious, they're just hanging around secular people at this age without a strong backing of a few years of yeshiva. So that's why it has to be within a certain kind of framework. And that's my answer to people. You have to just try to send them with that framework. Yes?
I wondered what you said to the French delegation from the parliament and whether you convinced them at all.
So it's good. The question was what I said to the French members of parliament. So my first reaction, and again, I had no training, I had no background in this whatsoever, I said to them, and I meant this rhetorically, I said, can one of you please tell me when the PLO was established? That's what I said. Would you believe, I wasn't trying to challenge them, 20 members of the French Parliament in the Knesset, to lobby the Knesset to stop, they didn't know the answer to that question. They didn't know. And I said to them, 1964, 1965, before there were any settlements, before the Six-Day War, if you think this conflict is about settlements, you completely do not understand this. Again, if you have criticism about settlements, we can talk about it. But that's separate from this is what the conflict is. If only Israel would do blank, then the whole problem would go away. And that's when I realize there is anti-Israel bias, that's true. There's also a tremendous amount of lack of education and misinformation. And that's what, when I would travel around, that's what I would do. So you ask me, was I successful? I would say there's yesh v'yesh. It depends. There are certain places where there were people who were willing to be intellectually honest, and they were willing to study the information that I was presenting them with. By the way, information about leading up to the formation of the State of Israel, but also, like I said, going back to 3,000 years ago. It touches people when they're presented with these kinds of facts and with this kind of conviction about that. In other cases, it didn't make a difference. It didn't make a difference. My goal with the real anti-Israel groups that I met with, especially in South Africa and a few other parliaments where you cannot imagine the venom that I was met with, my goal wasn't to make them flag waving Zionists, but just three things. Number one, they should not see Israel as apartheid. In other words, that, just fighting the use of that word. You know, going over what was apartheid in South Africa and what is the situation in Israel today. That's number one. Number two, to realize that Israel, with all the struggles that we have with the Palestinian conflict, we are a people that believe in human rights and justice, even if we struggle at times with it, from their perspective. And number three, that they should be against boycotts. They should be about investing, right? You want to help? Invest in the Palestinian people, not the leadership. Invest in them, right? Help them experience what a future can mean if they just stop with the terrorism and with the animosity. But that's sort of the approach that I would take, just to try to shift things a little bit. It's very hard to know how much you actually accomplish and don't in these meetings, but certainly when you open their eyes up to facts, I remember they were checking their phones to see if I was telling them the truth about the PLO, that makes a difference. Just willing to have an intellectually honest conversation. That's what I tried to do when in these efforts. Thank you, everyone. I'll stick around if you have any other questions.